From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More than a year after he began his campaign against Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary, challenging her as the candidate of Wall Street, and about 5 weeks after the last primary, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton, saying that she needed to be elected to protect the country against Donald Trump and big money in politics.
Secretary Clinton has won the Democratic nominating process, and I intend to do everything I can to make certain she will be the next president of the United States.
Sanders' announcement came 2 weeks before a single vote is cast at the Democratic National Convention, which begins on July 25th in Philadelphia. Neither Clinton nor Sanders have enough pledged delegates to win on a first ballot victory. Sanders' surprisingly strong showing was largely the result of hard work by many volunteers and receipts from small donors who were motivated by messages like this.
Now, I am not quite sure how you bring about real change in America if your super PAC collects millions and millions of dollars from Wall Street.
Secretary Clinton does represent the establishment. I represent, I hope, ordinary Americans.
The Green Party's presumptive nominee, Jill Stein, had something to say about Sanders' sudden turnaround on Clinton.
I think his endorsement of Hillary, is kind of the final nail in the coffin here. We've been offering Bernie Sanders basically to sit down and talk and to explore how we might collaborate for all sorts of possibilities, including leading the ticket, if he truly saw the light, the green light, you know, that we do need independent politics. And I think what's happened here, that the revolution is now being stuffed back into a counter-revolutionary party and into the campaign of the candidate who's really been leading the charge for Wall Street, for wars, and for the Walmart economy. You know, I think it's testimony to why we really do need an independent political force in which this movement can grow.
Presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump wasted no time in addressing Sanders' endorsement of Clinton.
Today I see Bernie Sanders gave her this very, you know, sort of strange endorsement. I want to tell you, a lot of Bernie Sanders people are so upset about it, they're going to be voting for Trump. I really believe that. They're going to be voting for Trump. They're going to be voting for Trump. Because the one thing that Bernie Sanders and I have in common was trade. Now, he can't do anything about it. He just knew it was bad. I know how to fix it. Because I am in favor of free trade. You know, a lot of people say I'm an isolationist, okay? Of course, when you're losing $800 billion a year on trade deficits, maybe that's not the worst thing. But we're going to straighten it out. I believe in open borders for trade. I believe in free trade. The problem we have is that virtually every single country that deals with us are far sharper and far better. They have their best negotiators. We have people that are political hacks negotiating for us. We have people that don't know what they're doing. I have the greatest businessmen in the world that have endorsed me. We have some of the greatest negotiators, maybe the greatest negotiators in the world. We don't use them. We use political hacks. We have people in there that got in for politics.
For more on that, we spoke with our regular political contributor, Tony Montero, former professor of African American Studies at Temple University. Professor Montero, welcome back. Pretty interesting day yesterday.
Definitely. Very interesting, Don. We're at the final stages of the presidential election of 2016. Both sides seem to be digging in and consolidating. Each side is consumed in contradictions, which I think could tear both coalitions, that is the Democratic Party coalition and the Trump insurgency coalition, apart. And all of this takes place under the shadow of a vast and historic protest movement that is sweeping across the country, sparked by the killings of Black young men and women in the streets and prisons and schools and hospitals of this country, essentially by the police. So this is a great and complicated moment, and yesterday was just the beginning of the next stage.
You know, working some of those contradictions, here's one that I see. For example, on the issues on the issue of police killings of young Black men, epidemic, and by the way, has never happened under any in any jurisdiction that Trump governed, but in fact is the result of some of Bill Clinton's legislation directly, and of course the militarization of police that continued through him, started in the 60s, accelerated, and also continues today. These are Obama's police that are killing people, yet they're trying to lay this they're going to try to lay this kind of stuff at Trump's feet.
Well, yes, they are going to try to do that. And I think that Trump has to not just be the conduit for the views and anxieties and even the racism of a lot of his followers, and he has to become the leader of them, not just their, as he puts it, their messenger, not just putting forward their anxieties. He has to become a leader if he intends to win. Now, obviously, the ruling elite see Trump and his movement and what remains of the Bernie Sanders movement after his endorsement of Clinton as an existential threat to the political system in the United States. And they want to stop the bleeding, stop the hemorrhaging. And therefore, they see the only way to do that is to unite around Hillary Clinton to stop this protest. And that's what it is. I mean, but Trump becomes a co-conspirator, if you will, in a situation which will only get worse. And by that, I mean, rather than clarifying issues, for example, the police and race, he wants to separate racism and white supremacy from policing policies. Now, we know in New York City, under Giuliani and others, that the broken windows policy and the stop and frisk policies were anti-Black, anti-Latino policies. So you cannot separate race from policing. But this is also the policy of the Bill Clinton administration, which went side by side with the criminalization of the Black community and the spike in mass incarceration. So that's the way I would put it right now.
Yeah, and here's another contradiction. Okay, so as they attempt to tamp down this rebellion, basically, we see Sanders trying to fold that part of the rebellion into the Democratic Party behind the entire political structure, a good chunk of the Republicans and the Democrats, and just people with a lot of money on Wall Street and other places, and. Trump needs them. And we have issues like the one we discussed just before this, for example, that you were just talking about, that have to be understood by Trump's side as a part of the movements in the streets, which he could lead. He says, I'm the law and order candidate. He could start saying, and that means, and he kind of did a little yesterday, but say, you know, when the police officer breaks the law and murders somebody, we prosecute them. Mm-hmm. No one's uttered those words, and that's the kind of thing that he's got to do. And so what do you think are the prospects for that?
I'm a little bit not hopeful that Trump will see the light and understand that if he wants the Bernie or bust people, the almost one-third of the people who voted for Bernie to vote for him, that he's going to have to not only say that they should join him, he's going to have to present a program, a rhetoric, a discourse that they can identify with. Now, most of what he does turns them off, you know. Now, but then if he, you know, focuses upon what is his strong hand, the economic questions, the infrastructure, rebuilding the infrastructure, the end of TPP, pulling back from NATO, how the national debt is tied up to, in large measure, wars of the future, the present, and of the past. We're still paying for them, including Iraq and Libya. And in fact, if you want to be real, Vietnam. So if he would connect these things, if he would talk about immigration as the result of NAFTA destroying the economy or the peasant agricultural economy of Mexico and forcing these desperate Mexican peasants and farmers and farm workers to seek an economic possibility in the United States. But he's not yet doing that. He is, however, the face of a real rebellion among the white working class. I think it's going to spread, especially in places like Lorain, Ohio, Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, Detroit, Michigan.
North Tarrytown, New York.
pardon me?
North Tarrytown, New York, Edison, New Jersey, etc.
Oh, definitely, definitely. The deindustrialized and impoverished and immiserated parts of the country. And poverty is an issue. I don't think I've heard him use the word poverty. We want to make America great again. But to make America great again, we have to attack the economic foundations of impoverishment of working people, people working full-time jobs and still in poverty, the collapse of the public school system. He has to connect these things. At this point, he is the face of an anxious uprising of white working people. But it is right now. It got him through the primary, but at this stage, it is definitely not enough. Now, clearly, Bernie Sanders' capitulation to Hillary Clinton, it is his capitulation, and I would suggest to people who exaggerate his influence over this movement, it is not the capitulation of his movement. There will be tens of thousands of people coming to Philadelphia to protest the Clinton presidency, the Clinton nomination, and the potential Clinton presidency. And that's the Bernie Sanders movement, not Bernie Sanders.
And Trump yesterday, after Sanders made the endorsement of Clinton, he one of the things that he hammered on was the fact that he's doing well in the polls in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio, and how he did in Indiana, of course, which put him over the top for the Republican convention. Going right there, he said, "You will get your jobs back." Now, people in Indiana are not just, you know, the people in the South, but they're the people in Gary, Indiana, and Indianapolis as well, and they're in the same economic condition, worse actually, than the white working class. Is it possible somehow to bridge the gap, particularly in this year where, on the Republican side, people voted for economics rather than abortion and, you know, cultural issues and such? Is it possible that there's some middle ground where, you know, large black cities like Detroit, Indianapolis, et cetera, could see Trump as a better alternative to Clinton?
It's possible, but you see, you can't say you're the law and order candidate and think that you're going to get significant numbers of black people to vote for you.
Yeah, it's code words in America. I mean, we remember Richard Nixon.
And we know that, you know. And in the face of, you know, 100 or more cities over the past week having significant anti-police state demonstrations, and these are black and white and Latino and Asian and Native American demonstrators, you can't call that a hate movement and expect to get black votes. So I think that black folk are concerned about the economic crisis and as concerned as anybody, but at the same time, they're concerned with state repression and racist police violence against their communities and the whole structure of white supremacy and racism in this country. So you can't appeal to black people on economics while at the same time insulting a movement that they have initiated against police repression in their communities. So, but then at the same time, there's an opportunity here. And because Hillary Clinton is so flawed, I mean, if anyone, in terms of policy and instituting white supremacist structures of imprisonment and mass incarceration and policing and policies of war and economic inequality and Wall Street and all that type of stuff, she is so flawed that Trump, if he has any sense and any sense of the world in which he lives, could capture capture the black imagination and create what I would call a tactical alliance between white working people and black working people against the candidate of Wall Street. We'll have to see if he can do it.
And, you know, sitting in his chair, forgetting who he is, his character and all that, which is another issue and which is a little ugly, too. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the Central Park thing, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But sitting in that seat, you sitting there or me sitting there and looking at, on the one hand, having to or traditionally having to hold on to the, well, let's go in advance of that. Whatever he's doing is happening within the context of the Clinton campaign. The Democratic Party is going to be adding to the anxieties that you just described with not just the kind of repression people are accustomed to, but actually of Trump unleashing a bunch of white working people with ropes on black people. They're thinking that he's doing that now to Mexicans and Muslims. We know who comes next. I'm certain of that. So, you know, with that context, he's looking at, on the one hand, traditionally, I have to hold on to the Republican base and have to say that, on the other hand, I need these people. Now, he's reconfigured the Republican Party already.
Right.
How does he
right.
get to reconfigure the national political thing by either nullifying or cutting off or changing that base so that it can be allies and seen as allies by the people he needs to reach? That's like the hard part. How do you do that?
Frankly, I don't think he's going to be able to do it. I could be wrong. I don't think he's going to be able to do it. But what he has done is to create a situation going forward after the election, even, of continued delegitimation of the system and of the political elite. Just like Occupy Wall Street introduced the concept of the 1% and the 99%, I think what Donald Trump has introduced into our political discourse is the idea that the whole system is rigged. And just like the Occupy Wall Street sensibility and argument and discourse is with us now, 4 years later, so I think the idea of a rigged system and a corrupt political and economic elite will be with us long after this election and will fuel movements of disaffection and protest. And you combine with this the zeitgeist, which goes way beyond the electorate. The electorate is not the majority of the people, and I think it will be a very limited electorate in this election, far smaller than in 2008 or 2012. But the movement goes way beyond that. And what I see is, you know, continued protest, growing protest, but also a growing ideological clarity. We already know from Pew studies of this country and around the world that in advanced capitalist countries, the majority of people feel that their economic and political elites are against them. And I think the United States might be the poster child of the delegitimation of the political system. And if Trump has made any contribution, it is in weakening the two-party system and creating space for a new type of movement and perhaps a new type of people's political party.
You know, it's also the gift that keeps on giving on that score. Just yesterday, his tweet in response saying that Sanders' endorsement of Clinton was like Occupy Wall Street endorsing Goldman Sachs. You know, there's going to be
right.
That's something that's going to be talking point for a lot of people, and it's a concept, very mm-hmm. nice little, you know, chunk that goes into people's skulls and stays there.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of that kind of thing, this delegitimization of everything, all of the structures, but particularly we're talking here political, opening up space for other political alternatives, like the creation of a mass workers' party, mm-hmm. or the changing of one, the reorienting of one, or in any event, the building of one that already exists, like the Green mm-hmm. Party. Jill mm-hmm. Stein has been campaigning on Sanders' issues. She tried, mm-hmm. up until now, to reach out to Bernie Sanders and say, look, if they kick you out of there, come, you could have my spot, right. basically. She said that's right. not exactly how it works, but essentially that. And what are the prospects for this? If, for example, we're going to see, I'm sure over the course of the general election, we've already seen more than hints of it. They're going to try to lift up the Libertarian Party, the power elite, in order to mm-hmm. cut Trump's vote, mm-hmm. particularly if he starts polling very well. Mm-hmm. Does the Green Party have space, and can it become a magnet for the working class? And then, of course, if that happens, which, of course, is maybe remote, but if that happens, how do you prevent them from breaking up the working class as a voting bloc by pulling, say, half mm-hmm. of Trump's people or less?
Well, I think the Green Party and Jill Stein are going to do quite well. I mean, Jill Stein, I think, has done a magnificent job up to this point. She becomes a, as you say, a magnet for the Bernie or some of the Bernie or bust people. The Bernie Sanders people have three choices. Either don't vote for Jill Stein, or vote for Donald Trump. In each instance, it's an act of protest against the political system and Hillary Clinton in particular. So protest and a widening and deepening and more united movement is the future. It's not like Occupy Wall Street in 2012, where they shut down the encampments and the movement was gone, was erased. I think that this is a movement that occupies the future. It is the future. It is a growing movement. Now, the question is, to what extent will the Trump people and the Bernie people, broadly understood, those who hear Trump and follow Trump and agree with him, and those who hear Bernie and followed him and heard him, whether these two movements, along with the Black Lives Matter movement and other movements, the environmental anti-fracking movement, whether or not all of this can be brought together. And certainly, if we're talking about a workers' party, the first thing on the agenda is the organization of the unorganized. The trade union leadership has failed the working class of this country. The little things that they have achieved are so small in the face of the war against working people. Only 6% of non-public sector workers are in union. I mean, that is a crime against humanity. And so going forward, the linking of all of these movements into a great action synthesis, a new movement, a movement of a new type. This, to me, is the task of the moment, more important than the formation of an electoral party. We need a movement. And you know, if I might just say, Don, it's my opinion that the party that we're talking about will only crystallize and come into existence at the moment where the people are prepared to take power. And I don't think before that. I think anything of a political party organization of a mass character attempt at that, that occurs before the people are on the verge of taking power will be premature. The task of the moment is to build this new type of movement, this united movement, this movement that becomes more conscious and ideologically clear over time, and that takes up the issues of the working class, including the organization of the unorganized, the organization of the unemployed, the organization of the poor. The movements are not separate and apart from the crisis of the ruling elite, and they know they're in a crisis. Brexit was the most dramatic expression of it thus far, a complete rejection of both parties and their political elites and most of the leaders of the trade unions in Britain. We are looking at something very similar here. So we have a ruling class who sees its house on fire. It does not know how to pull it back together. In May, they recalibrated the numbers of jobs created from 38,000 down to 11,000. And then they come out in July with June figures that say something like 178,000 jobs were created. I don't believe it. Most of them are part-time jobs. So we are looking at another great recession, an epic recession, which could come in the middle of this electoral time. Even in spite of everything, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, the media, and the government are going to do to hold it back. I think we're looking at, if that happens, all bets are off. And I think, if I might just add this, I think the way that Trump could win is if there is an economic recession. And as quiet as it's kept, if you listen to him, he is kind of betting on a economic downturn of significant character that would propel him way in front of Clinton and thus to the presidency. But I don't think he wins other than that. But he so shakes up the system that he doesn't have to win. That anybody, that if Hillary wins, it will be the most difficult, crisis-ridden presidency in the history of the United States, perhaps. She will be a president that the vast majority of people reject and do not trust.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.